Welcome to another episode of the Team EF Coaching Performance Podcast, where we take information from the highest level of sport and make it accessible for all cyclists. I'm your host, Zach Morris, and in this episode, I sit down with the head of medicine from EF Pro Cycling, Dr. Kevin Sprouse, where we have an interesting conversation discussing the importance of strength training, protecting your immune system, and a few other tips and tricks that you might be able to incorporate into your routine to help get more performance out of your efforts. So sit down and enjoy this episode. All right, Dr. Kevin Sprouse, welcome to the Team EF Coaching Podcast. We are so excited to have you here.
Zach, thanks for having me. It's good to join you guys.
So Kevin, you are a very dynamic person right now in the sports performance space. If we take a look at your website, it looks like you're not only the director of medicine for EF Pro Cycling, but you're also involved in a lot of other professional sports, helping athletes across the board maximize their performance. So if you wouldn't mind, could you just give us a little bit of a background on kind of who you are and what you're dabbling in these days?
So my background, I studied exercise physiology in undergraduate at university, and then went to medical school, trained in emergency medicine as my primary specialty, and then did subspecialty training in sports medicine. And when I first started, got out of fellowship, started my practice, my goal was to bring the tenets of sports medicine and performance to the greater medical care of the athlete, which, I mean, sounds like it should happen naturally, but it doesn't. The medical profession tends to be a little bit siloed from the performance aspect of things, especially in the U.S. And so my goal was really to focus on health, well-being, kind of optimization of performance, but not at the sacrifice of optimization of health as well for my athletes. And so when I started working with the EF team in previous iterations, which was 12 to 13 years ago, that was always the goal, was to put health of the athlete first and foremost, because a healthy athlete is going to perform well. So then as I built my practice, that was always kind of my go-to, is we're going to look deep in the sports science, do everything we can to promote performance, but always with the number one goal of promoting health. And I think that's resonated with a number of folks, such that I've worked with professional triathletes, track and field athletes, Major League Baseball players, PGA golfers, really pretty a wide spectrum of professional athletes, and then recreational athletes as well across multiple disciplines. So a lot of times the recreational athletes are the ones who almost have it harder to meet those goals. So currently my practice now is about 50-50 pro athletes, recreational athletes, and really helping bring the tenets from the pro athletes to the recreational crowd is a lot of fun because they're so limited in time and what they can do. So that's the short version, but that also maybe provides a little of the rationale to why we dig so deep into the sports science part of it.
So that's pretty cool. So you studied exercise phys, then you went and became an MD, worked in a hospital, right? In the ER, mm-hmm. Was it the ER you worked in?
And there was about 10 or 12 years I was an ER doctor.
That's crazy. So you're working in the ER. This isn't a short period of time, 10 or 12 years. And the whole time, did you like know at some point you're like, hey, man, like, what I really want to be doing is working with pro athletes?
Well, so it was actually concurrent.
Okay.
The way it happened is during my residency where I was training in emergency medicine, I was in New York City. And there was a point about halfway through my training where I had a really rough night. And those weren't hard to come by, but it was one particularly hard night. And I came home the next morning, was home. I was actually watching the Tour de France, and they interviewed a guy named Prentice Stephan, who was the team doctor for Slipstream, back when we were maybe Garmin Transitions at the time, or maybe even Slipstream Sports, but early iteration, maybe the first Tour de France they did. And Prentice was talking about his background in both emergency medicine and sports medicine, formal training in each, and how it got him to work with the team. And it just it kind of blew my mind. I was like, I didn't know that was a career path. And so I got in touch with him, which was kind of him to have the conversation. And we just stayed in touch. And as I went through my training, really realized that this is what I wanted to do. So I was fortunate to come out of training straight into what then was the development team for this team. It was called Chipotle was the team sponsor. And that was the under 23 team. It was Alex Howes, Lachlan Morton, a whole bunch of great guys, some of whom went on to the world tour, some of whom didn't. And you know, from that team, I moved on to the world tour team. And so really from the outset, I was working in pro cycling. So I would come home to the US. I live in Tennessee. I would work in the emergency department, 6, 8, 10 shifts a month, depending on my travel schedule. And then the other times I'd be in Europe working with the team and just kind of do a back and forth.
So what is it about that like ER dynamic where you're in the hospital working with regular people? Sounds crazy, but like regular people, not pro athletes, with regular problems, which are probably big problems. What is it about that experience and a passion for sports performance that makes apparently such a great combination when it comes to applying all this to pro athletes?
I think there's two sides of it. One, working in emergency medicine, you do get to see all the pitfalls of not paying attention to your health. So admittedly, as a doctor, there were times that I got very frustrated with patients in the emergency department because it was just like a broken record. You know, not taking care of themselves, very destructive behaviors where some very small interventions would have gone a long way. I'm not saying that frustration was the right response on my part, but I think after a certain period of time, it's a little bit inevitable.
Well, especially when you're leading from like just wanting people to be healthy, right? It's understandable,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people who are coming in with the same problem every week and you get to know them, you're like, if you'll just do a little bit of exercise and take your medications, I won't see you for months and that'd be great for you, right? So there was a little bit of that, admittedly, but I think even more so, and this also sounds kind of bad, but having that emergency background in cycling, in sports medicine in general, it's a good thing because you never know what you're going to be presented with as the team doctor in a given scenario. But in cycling, you're not in a stadium. You're not somewhere where there are resources set up for you. You know, in a football team, you can go into the stadium, under the stadium, get x-rays, imaging. Like, you've basically got a small clinic right there. Mm-hmm. For us on the road, you've got a small bag of things that you hope are what you need, and you've really got to improvise a bit. And there's a lot of emergency medicine in that mentality. And so I think it suits emergency medicine suits cycling well. And we've actually focused in our team on having doctors who all have emergency medicine experience to a reasonable degree.
Gosh, I got to ask, what's in that bag? What are your tools of choice?
Oh, man. It is extensive. It's a little bit of everything. So it's like I don't have two of anything except for, you know, like Tylenol and Advil, ibuprofen, like the things that are just going to come up. But mostly it's, you know, it's a splint, it's a sling. I carry an ultrasound device that I can plug into my iPhone. And with the ultrasound, I can look at, you know, deep soft tissue injuries. I can look to see if somebody's got a fracture. We can really use that as a in the field diagnostic tool that is just, I love it. I mean, 8 years ago, we couldn't do that. And so
wow,
having that to plug in has been, for me, indispensable. Lots of bandages. And then really just the run of medications. And these are all over the counter things. I mean, I carry a few antibiotics and things like that in case we're stuck somewhere, but mostly you're kind of expected to be the pharmacy on the road.
Okay.
And again, it's eye drops, it's allergy medications, stuff like that that just come up. So having a little of everything is key.
That is wild. It's like the ultimate medical doctor survival kit. If you had to pick your battle weapons to go out and heal people on the fly in probably the most dangerous sport in the world, what would you take with you? Cool. Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny that the first couple World Tour races I did always came back and it's like, I've got this giant bag and what they needed was something I didn't have. Right. So it's a learning process. You kind of hone the list that you carry and eventually nail it.
Cool. So when you hire a new doctor on the team, do you like send them the essential starter kit? Like, this is the guide to professionals. Like,
absolutely. Yeah. I've got a 3 or 4 page sheet checklist that I send to them.
Awesome. So I think that's probably one of the biggest questions that people have out there. You know, what does a medical doctor and a professional cycling team actually do day to day?
Yeah, it's pretty varied. So I think there's two scenarios to look at. One is on the road and one at home. So on the road, in the few days leading up to on the road, we're in touch with all the athletes that are programmed for that race, the ones that are supposed to race it, and the alternates, reserves, whatever, and just make sure they're healthy going into the race. And then we arrive, check on everybody. It's fairly informal, that checking process. You know, I try to just make sure I sit down. Hey, how you doing? How you been feeling? Typically the answer should be, I feel great. I'm ready to race, because we've had that interaction with them ahead of time. And we're also very adamant that riders not show up to races sick. They shouldn't be, you know, 80 or 90% and hope they're going to get better at a race. They should be firing on all cylinders, or else, that might be a time to sit it out and change the schedule. So early on in a race, it's pretty low key. And then during the race, you know, morning, I usually get out and go for a run, try to do something that's going to be my time, because that's gone very quick.
So you're talking about like the longer, like the grand tours and things of that sort at this point.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, anything, because even a 1 day race, we'll get there 2 days before. We'll probably leave the day after. It's like a 4 day block. And I like to stay active. I mean, I'm no competitive athlete, but I usually don't go more than a day or two without doing something fairly structured in terms of exercise.
You'd better be with all this focus on health, Mr. Sprouse.
That's right. Yeah, I totally agree. And so it's also good for my head, because I'm going to be sitting in the car all day, pretty sedentary. And I start to get kind of twitchy if I haven't done something.
Okay.
And so I'll go for a little run early in the morning before anybody's up, get back to the hotel. And then as the guys are waking up, kind of be around breakfast, obviously I'm going to eat something, but really to check on them and just kind of say, hi, how's it going? How'd you sleep? Just these touch points. It's nothing, there's no critical communication, but it's the accessibility and the availability of communication.
Okay.
Then we head to the race. I'm in the bus usually. So again, just kind of checking on guys, talking to them, pretty informal. And then around at the start. So, if we need to deal with any injuries that have been ongoing, you know, taping, anything like that, you know, taping a joint, taping a knee, taping a shoulder, just kind of being around. And then I'm in the car. And honestly, the car is, if all things go well, the car is pretty boring. You know, I sit in the front seat, chat with the director, the mechanic, telling jokes, maybe listen to a little music until the race is really on. And then, you know, there's an hour and a half, 2 hours of kind of tense time in the car, and then it's over. So, then it's back to the hotel, kind of rinse and repeat the next day, checking on them at the hotel, of course, whatever, but you know, that's just how it looks. So hopefully I don't end up in a hospital.
Yeah. Hope we all hope you do not end up in a hospital. That's for sure. So
yeah.
What are you doing when you're at home and you're not in the car and doing these things on the go?
Yeah. So at home, aside from my practice, what I do is I set aside time throughout the week where I have scheduled in basically time to review certain things about riders. So we use Whoop to monitor some of their biometrics from a distance. You know, how are they sleeping? How are they recovering? Things like that. We use Training Peaks, and we have a proprietary software that pulls a lot of this data into a kind of a training and performance dashboard. And so I'll go into those various platforms and just kind of look for red flags, you know, somebody who's not recovering well, not sleeping well, et cetera, and just see if any contact needs to be made there. And then there's usually some ongoing issues with riders. So if there's somebody that maybe I was just at a race with who was injured, maybe ended up in the hospital having surgery, whatever, then I'll be in contact with them, be in contact with their physiotherapist, and just kind of see that process through as well. So it's a bit more oversight as opposed to being face to face, obviously, when I'm home, but it's still kind of this consistent touching base with riders and touching base with the other medical staff, performance staff, et cetera.
Interesting. So what are some of the common things that you see maybe going wrong at the professional cycling level?
I mean, from an injury standpoint, it's most, we kind of divide them into traumatic injuries and overuse injuries. So the traumatic ones, I mean, are, I guess, by definition avoidable, but they're kind of hard to, like, nobody's trying to get, have a crash and a clavicle fracture, but
I love that. I love that when people, you're heading out for a ride and your friends are like, yeah, be safe out there. Like, yeah, I'm going to do my best to not crash.
Oh, thanks for that reminder.
Yeah.
But clavicle, wrist, knee, hip, those are the things that tend to hit the ground. And so, you know, those would be traumatic issues. But the ones that you can pay a little more attention to from a preventive standpoint are, like you mentioned, the illnesses, the fatigue related things, even the overuse injuries have to do with bike setup and physical fitness going into long training blocks. And what I mean by that, of course, there's the aerobic fitness, but the musculoskeletal fitness. And so a lot of athletes neglect to do the appropriate strength and mobility training, especially a lot of us endurance athletes. We would rather be on the bike, out on the trail, on the road, doing our thing as opposed to in a gym. But it's so important. You know, that's where you really build the resilience that allows you to add kilometers on top of that, right? To really grow your training program. And so I think attention to that, especially as we get older, and by older, I mean over the age of 30. So I'm considerably older at this point, but once you hit the age of 30, there's really no reason you should not be doing strength or resistance training, conditioning year round. There'll be a periodization to it, right? So you may have a higher load of strength training and higher weight in the off season, but it should be something you're doing year round. And that's unequivocal in the literature. And so that's something I think really needs to be paid attention to. From a fatigue standpoint, you know, fatigue definitely predisposes someone to like upper respiratory tract infections. And of course, the last couple of years, everything has been either COVID or not COVID, right? So every upper respiratory infection, you kind of get a swab and you're like, oh, it's okay, it's not COVID. That's all well and good, but it's also hard to perform if you've got a cold or a flu or something like that. And some of them you certainly shouldn't perform. You should just shut it down. And I think a lot of the things that we learned or that we paid attention to through COVID in terms of the importance of sleep, recovery, proper hydration, proper nutrition, proper hygiene. Those things need to continue because they serve to keep us healthy the rest of the time as well. And we've kind of paid attention to that in cycling, almost to the point that people would laugh at cyclists for opening doors with their elbows and not shaking hands and, you know, all these kind of odd activities during a grand tour because they're a little bit immune depressed with that type of training load. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden the whole world started doing the same thing and cyclists became normal.
Right. That's funny. You know, it's interesting to hear you put a big emphasis on the strength training. I did a podcast with TJ Van Garderen, who you obviously know very well. And on that show, I asked him, I said, what would you change if you could change anything looking back now on your career? And he said, I would have focused so much more on strength training. When you look at the riders at the top of the sport today, they're not as frail and skinny as they once were when we look back at, let's say, just a different physiology in somebody like Chris Froome and Alberto Contador. When we look at Pogačar and Remco and Wout, they're a little bit thicker. They're not quite as light, but they have more power, doing PR, setting times faster than ever, right?
Absolutely. And they have more resilience. And so you see someone who can, you know, surprise you on a climb, Van Aert, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, goes out and all of a sudden he's there. They're not dropping him. Like, what is going on? And then the next day he's there again. And the next day he's there again. And it really goes to both performance and resilience when you look at strength training. And I think if you look back through the years, like you were saying, some of the really thin climbers who had amazing performances and were incredible cyclists, one of their big limiters was how long were they able to do it in a season, right? How long before they got injured, sick, any number of things that slowed them down, where we know you put on a couple more kilograms of mass, but it's muscle, it's metabolically active, and you put it on in the right place. Yeah, you've got to carry it up the mountain, but you've got more power generating tissue to do that. So there's a point at which it cancels out. I mean, certainly you can't just be massive on the bike and be at the front of the peloton, but there's a lot of room historically to add some muscle weight and benefit from it as opposed to having it pull you back.
Well, I'm not sure the science was there previously, and also the technology was there to support this new style of riding. When we look at the nutrition that it takes to fuel these bigger riders, right? We've got way better nutrition than we did in the past. We've got better bikes, better equipment, better wheels, better everything to support a more powerful rider, uses a lot more glycogen and produces a lot more power. So it's interesting to see the sport evolve. So in terms of strength training being the, you know, number one thing that you would recommend to avoid injury, and then, you know, monitoring illness through avoiding fatigue or trying not to get too fatigued being the two kind of main points of staying generally healthy, is there anything else that you would add on top of those two things to an athlete's game out there to try to optimize what they're doing and just stay consistent?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are big points and big topics too. I mean, you can dig into those. There's certainly times that you should be fatigued, right? Like if you're never getting fatigued, if you always wake up fresh, you're probably not training hard enough. So the point is it should be cyclical and periodized. So periodization, I would throw in there too. However, I mean, there's 100 ways to do it, but the concept is the important thing, that there are times to go deep, you know, across a number of days. And there are times where you need to just back it off and have either an easy week or time entirely off the bike. I like athletes to have at least two off seasons during a year where they just pull the plug, hike, be active, like do things that you don't normally do, that you don't normally train at, but get away from your primary modality and then come back to it. So that, I think, is a big part of it. The other one you mentioned, though, nutrition, is huge. And I think it's an area where there is so much, I was going to say pseudoscience. It's not really that. It's just poor science and poor interpretation of the science, that people get very dogmatic about nutrition as opposed to kind of having an openness to the broader ideas that are supported by the literature. So what I mean by that is people tend to focus on something very small and aim for it, whether that's you know, a certain amount of protein, a certain amount of carbs, a vegan diet, whatever, and just be all in. And that's like their thing. You know, they're the paleo person. As opposed to saying, well, you know, yeah, there's probably benefit in increasing my protein a little bit. There's probably benefit in adding some vegetables and being paleo-ish, but I do really well on the bike when I throw in some grains and some more carbohydrates, and start to figure out that it's not black and white, but there's a lot of things that we do know that is low-hanging fruit, that if you just focus on those and kind of tick the basic boxes, you can do incredible things for yourself in terms of performance and recovery.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think a lot of these like diets that people fall into are not well balanced, especially for sports performance. The one I found that I think can be the most well-rounded if you apply it right is the blood type diet. Have you done any research on that?
I will say that I've not. I'm only vaguely familiar with it. And Yeah, tell me, because I'm skeptical.
Okay. So I grew up my whole life. My dad was the first guy in Canada to bench press 600 pounds. So all of my brothers are pro athletes. I got two younger brothers who are professional soccer players in the MLS. Like, our family is super high performance focused. So I grew up with my dad, like, don't eat red meat. It's bad for you. You got to eat chicken and fish and stay lean. And like this mentality, right? So my friend, who invented this product called the So Right. He's like a, you know, a bit of a fitness guru. He hates the word guru, but he's totally
great product, by the way.
Yeah. Great. Oh, you product. Like it? You love it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's actually down here in Medellin right now where I live. And we go to the gym every day together, but he's constantly turning me on to these new things. Like, Zach, I've tried every diet under the sun, the fruit diet, this. He's like, I think you would love the blood type diet, so give it a shot. So I'm like, okay, I'm looking up the foods that are good for me. I'm B, so I need to be eating no chicken, apparently, and a lot more red meats. And so I started doing this blood type diet, and actually I started to feel amazing. No more gas after high protein diets. Started to eliminate some of the vegetables that I loved to eat because my dad told me they were good for me when I was younger, and all the nutrition books say you need to eat these things. Started eliminating some of these things that the blood type diet told me that I needed to eliminate, and I reduced inflammation. I feel pretty darn good. I have no science to support it whatsoever. All I can tell you is that I feel better doing the blood type diet. Now, of course, you have to like frame some structure around it, right? Because the blood type diet doesn't tell you how much of what to eat, how much vegetables to eat with your proteins and how many carbs to eat and all of those things. So you still need some nutritional guidance there in order to frame it all. But in terms of like food selection, I found it really, really helpful.
Well, and that's hard to argue with, right? Like, if you're feeling better at the end of the day, if what you have migrated to are whole foods, you know, not processed, otherwise pretty healthy, you're getting kind of a wide variety of foods and you feel great. I mean, who can argue with that, right? I'm okay with that. But I'll have to look more into the blood type diet. I have a hard time making the connection between, or a causative connection between, your blood type and what you should eat. Doesn't mean it can't happen. But the point being, I think a lot of times too, when we make dramatic shifts in what we're doing, oftentimes we'll, I won't even say stumble across, because, you know, sometimes it's very intentional, but it will occur that you cut out something that you were maybe eating too much of, because we become very rote in our diets. You know, this is what my breakfast looks like. This is what lunch looks like. This is what dinner looks like. And it tends to just kind of repeat, right? So when you do mix it up, a lot of times you cut out some things that you've kind of been maybe overwhelming the body with, just doing a little bit too much of. And those diets that are very repetitive, even the healthiest one, you end up with holes. So no meal is perfect, right? And say your meal is a little bit low in iron and B12 and zinc, this meal, right? But okay, not a big deal. You're ticking a lot of other boxes. It's otherwise healthy. But if you do that every single time you have dinner, that small hole, those three small holes are just going to get amplified, right? So then you switch it up and all of a sudden you're getting a good source of B12 and iron and zinc. I think that's what I said. I just made that up, by the way. I'm just picking three. But the point is, then you start with variety, you start to hit more of your targets. And so when we switch things up, a lot of good can come from that, almost irrespective of what it is you switch to. But I am, one thing I've changed my tune on across 12 or 15 years is, early on, I didn't really buy into this idea of food sensitivities. Like, I kind of thought, look, you're allergic to something or you're not, right? And the things that we pawn off on food sensitivity, probably other issues going on. And what I would tell you now is that the latter part of that, I still agree. People look for things that are done to them, right? Like, they're happening to them as opposed to consequences of their actions. So, and I'm guilty of this too. So it's a lot easier to say, oh, the reason I feel this way is because, you know, this thing keeps coming into my body. You know, it was chicken, it was whatever. And I'm not saying it to you, I'm just throwing the example out there. It was eggs, it was whatever. you know, and I think there is still the tendency to do that because it's much easier for us to do that and say, actually, the reason I feel like crap is because I've been sedentary and not sleeping well and I've been drinking too much alcohol, right? It had nothing to do with the eggs or whatever else.
Those ER traumas coming back to you.
Yeah, exactly. But that said, I'm now much more convinced that there is kind of a gradient of food reactivity that people have. Some people are not terribly reactive. Some are. And finding those things that add to the inflammatory load that are dietary, I think can be really important for athletes. And I first kind of started having my mind changed on this when there was a pro cyclist I was working with who insisted on doing a food sensitivity test because he wanted to get off of his asthma medications. And I was just like, I don't get it. Like, I don't understand the connection there, but fine. We did it. He was frequently eating some of the things that came up as being highly reactive, high food sensitivities for him. And he stopped eating those and was actually able to get off his asthma medications.
Wow.
It shocked me. And I've seen similar since. I've seen many cases where that doesn't work out too. So I'm not saying that everyone on asthma or everyone who has asthma should take a food sensitivity test and get off their meds. Like that's far right. from it.
Right.
But I have seen some instances through the years where an elimination diet can really lower the inflammatory load for someone. And by doing so, decrease or eliminate the symptoms they were having from that inflammation, which again, that's something I've had to come around to, but I'm pretty convinced that it can happen. It's not the case for everyone, but that is something that's kind of an issue for people.
Fascinating. Hey, Kevin. So we've talked about strength training. And again, these are massive categories, strength training to prevent injuries, nutrition to obviously help in so many different areas, right? And fatigue, keeping the immune system healthy. I want to ask you about the latest trend, right? Reverse aging. Have you ever seen this going around? What's your take on it? Because I went down the rabbit hole. I was like, you know what? I heard that if you go in a hyperbaric chamber every single day for 60 to 90 minutes, you can reverse the internal age of your cells. I went in there. I only lasted a week. And then life came up and I was like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do all the blood work and I'm going to do it right. And I actually want to know what happened over the course of 30 days. But I got to be honest, at the end of the week, I felt good, right? So what's your take on it from like a science perspective? Am I crazy? Am I just like making stuff up? Or are there benefits to like this? Is this real? Is this reverse aging thing maybe real?
Well, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I won't tell you if you're crazy or not. So let's step it back a little bit. There's a big focus on slowing or reversing aging, probably in the last 5 to 10 years. And a lot of it's coming to the forefront just in general society right now. And I think that's for a few reasons. We don't need to get into the why, but it's becoming the forefront. Along with that, there are more tests coming out that you can do to kind of see your biological age, which is this idea that you've got a chronological age, which is just how many years have you been alive? You know, it starts at your birthday and you count up. Biological age is looking at certain biomarkers and then determining the age, quote unquote, of your cells based on that. And so it's really kind of tricky because the way that those tests, often called clocks, are constructed varies widely between between the available commercial tests. Okay. And so the gold standard is what's known as methylation of your epigenome or methylation of your genome, which is a measure of epigenetics. Epigenetics being the environmental factors, the external factors that turn your genes on and off. Okay. So in other words, you could be predisposed to lung cancer, but if you don't smoke, you may never get it. Smoking is that external factor that kind of turns it on or off, right? And that happens for all of our genes. So that's the gold standard, is looking at those methylation patterns. But there are a lot of companies that use blood work, they use blood glucose, vitamin D levels, liver enzymes, all kinds of things as a bit of a proxy for that, and then try to estimate. And the problem is those are really variable. I mean, your blood glucose from one day to the next, even if it's fasting, could vary by 20 points, right? Wow. So your biological age could change by years from one day to the next when actually nothing's happened. So that's problematic. Doing the epigenetic test is probably much more high resolution and accurate, if that's the right word. And that's what I do with patients when we do these things. But even that, you have to kind of understand the statistics and how these algorithms are trained and things like that. So it's kind of a gray science. The other side of it is there's been a lot of popularization of things like using metformin or rapamycin or some of these pharmaceuticals that have been shown in certain situations to probably have a lifespan increasing effect. So the thought is, you know, if you use it when you're healthy, it might actually decrease your lifespan. I mean, I'm sorry, decrease your age and increase your lifespan. The studies are often done either in animal models or on individuals with chronic illnesses, and they kind of see the signal and wonder if it might play out to the rest of us. So all that to say, it's interesting and it's fun. And I think you have to look at each intervention and see how much weight there is to it. So, you know, hyperbaric oxygen, resveratrol, things like that. You know, how much weight is there really there, and how are you going to measure it? And unless you have a good grasp of those things, it's really just kind of playing around with no firm endpoint. And there's nothing wrong with that at all, assuming the intervention is safe, right? So for a lot of them, the best things you can do to slow aging or to reverse your biological age, which isn't to say that you're reversing your aging, but like improve your physiology to the point that it's as if it was a younger person. The best things you can do aren't for sale at a recovery center or, you know, a GNC or a Whole Foods. They are, you know, exercise, sleep, avoiding things that are really detrimental like smoking, and then making sure that you get plenty of vegetables, adequate protein, avoid processed foods. Like, it's not sexy, but those things still far outweigh going to the hyperbaric chamber or taking resveratrol or doing whatever else. That said, I've been to hyperbaric chambers. I've taken resveratrol. I've tried these things. Like, I totally get it, but we just have to keep them in check. If you're not doing the other things, if you haven't nailed the really meaningful lifestyle factors, focus on those first.
So let's say, hypothetical scenario here, you're pretty healthy. I think most of our listeners are exercising, you know, 3 to 5, maybe 7 times, maybe 10 times a week. We got a lot of active people on the channel. Do you think there are benefits in doing some of these things like the hyperbaric trainer, resveratrol, some of these other things that you mentioned?
I think there probably is some benefit situationally. So picking the right person, the right reason to do it. I don't think we'll ever know definitively, because you can't do that study well, right? Like, you can't get two groups of people, have one of them do 3 times a week hyperbaric chamber oxygenation, and have them do that to the end of their life, keeping all other variables held steady, and you know, 50, 60 years later, see what effect it had. So you have to kind of you have to extrapolate a bit from other studies. You have to look at the animal models. You have to weigh all kinds of things. For me, when we're looking at these things, it's often specific to an issue a patient might have. And then we're going to pick an intervention based on that. And we're only going to do it if it looks like there's mechanistic probability for benefit. Like, it makes sense that it could work. There's some science behind it. And most importantly, there's no signal that suggests that it could be dangerous, right? We don't want to fly too close to the sun with this stuff, in my opinion, because again, we're playing with a bit of an unknown. So with hyperbaric oxygen,
there, I mean, you can do too much of anything, but it's probably pretty safe, right? Done in a reasonable manner. Not diving too deep in the chamber and not, you know, spending days on end in there. Like, it's probably okay. And you can see how you feel. There are other things where you might want to be careful and just kind of let the science evolve a bit before. You don't want to be the first person to do something, put it that way.
Fair play. Well, thanks so much for answering those questions. I've been waiting for this podcast for like a month to ask you your opinion on that reverse aging.
Well, happy to do it.
Yeah. It's just so exciting to be constantly trying new things and then being able to share your experience with other people who are, you know, looking to get better. And that's the one of the interesting things about the cycling space in general is you're kind of surrounded by a lot of people who are always on this pursuit of just evolving and being better and being healthier and performing at a better standard. And I think it's also such a good space because in that world exists a lot of great people, right? So it's,
oh yeah,
it's fun to be able to share all these different wild tests that you put yourself through. So I think that concludes much of which I wanted to kind of, you know, ask you about today. Is there anything that you want to add for people out there that, you know, might evolve on what we had discussed? Maybe anything at all?
No, I think what I would add, which is really just kind of maybe tying it all together, is that, I mean, I kind of jokingly say, you know, it's easy to say you got to focus on the basics. But the basics aren't necessarily boring, right? Like that's why we love to ride the bike. And so getting that type of activity, you know, cycling is uniquely suited to some of this very metabolically beneficial, longer endurance activity, zone two stuff. And then being able to throw in these high intensity intervals that really push your fitness level. And that's what we're trying to accomplish on the bike, is build that aerobic base and then build that high end on top of it. And that helps us perform in our sport. But what's really beautiful, I think, is if we could get other patients, if we could write a training program for them that would be the most beneficial from a health and even longevity standpoint, that would be what we do for them. We'd say, okay, go out. I want you getting hours of zone two work. And then, you know, some high intensity efforts, not really on the side, but to a lesser degree, but you know, legitimate training. And that's going to move the needle more than almost anything else that you can do from the standpoint of health and longevity, and performance comes right along with it. So these things, they do interweave, and the stuff that we as cyclists love really is the heart and soul of it. So to me, that's a lot of fun. And I would imagine, you know, those people who are taking part of EF coaching and, you know, really signing in every day, looking at their workout, what's prescribed, they're doing it because it's fun. Not every workout is fun, but the process is fun. A lot of the workouts, the time on the bike is fun. And at the end of the day, the side benefit you get is health and presumed increase in longevity.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's what we're aiming for. It's pretty cool when I log into the dashboard and I see how many people we're able to help every single day. Not only just, you know, ride faster, but look better, feel better, and also have better mental resilience as well. Because that's the beautiful thing about cycling, is you're forced to solve a lot of problems every single time you get out on the road. How are you going to get over this climb? How are you going to make it down this hill? How are you going to get through this storm? You're constantly solving, you know, pretty tough issues every single day out there on the bike. And so it's a special place to be. And we're happy, of course, to have you in the community, such a great asset to the entire community. And I just want to say a massive thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing so much of your wisdom with us today. It was very insightful and just awesome. So thank you, Mr. Kevin.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. Good questions. And yeah, fun time.
And so this concludes this episode of the Team EF Coaching Performance Podcast with Dr. Kevin Sprouse. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you're not already subscribed, and feel free to drop us a comment or tweet at us on Instagram or Twitter at Team EF Coaching to let us know what you want to hear about in some upcoming episodes. Everybody take care.